Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the fourth canto, chapter 22. Chapter is entitled Pitu Maharaj's Meeting with the Kumaras. And today is text 48. That's what's here? 48? Maitreya Uvacha.
Maitreya Uvacha.
Ka.
Ka.
Atma Yoga.
Atma Yoga.
Vataya.
Vataya.
Adi.
Adi.
Vajena.
Vajena.
Pujitaha.
Pujitaha.
Shilam.
Shilam.
Tadiyam.
Tadiyam.
Shamsanta.
Ke
Bhavan
Mishatam
Vinam
Maitreya
Uvacha
Ka
Atma Yoga Pataya
Adi
Rajena
Pujitaha
Shilam Tadiyam Shamstanta Ke Bhavan Mishatam Ninam Maitreya
Uvacha
Ta Atma Yoga Pattaya
Hari
Rajena Pujitaha
Shilam
Tadiyam Shamshantaha Ke Bhavan Mishatam Ninam chant.
Maitreya Uvacha.
Maitreya Uvacha.
Atma Yoga Pataya.
Atma Yoga Pataya.
Hari Rajena Pujita.
Hari Rajena Pujita.
Shilam Tadiyam Samsanta.
Shilam Tadiyam Samsanta.
Maitreya Uvacha
Atma Yoga Pataya
Adi Rajena Pujita
Shilam Tadiyam Samsanta
Kebhavan Mishatam Vina Maitreya Uvacha.
Maitreya Uvacha.
The great sage Maitreya continued to speak.
The great sage Maitreya continued to speak.
Te.
Te.
De.
De.
Atma Yoga
Pataya. Atma Yoga Pataya.
The masters of self-realization by devotional service.
Adi Rajena.
By the original King Pritu.
Pujita,
being worshipped.
Shilam,
character.
Tadiyam,
of the King.
Shamsanta,
eulogizing.
Ke,
in the sky.
Abhavan,
appeared.
Mishatam,
while observing.
Ninam,
of the people.
Translation and purport
by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The great sage Maitreya continued, being thus worshipped by Maharaj Pritu, the four Kumaras, who were masters of devotional service, became very pleased. Indeed, they appeared in the sky and praised the character of the king, and everyone observed them. Please repeat. The great sage Maitreya continued. Being thus worshipped by Maharaj Prithu, the four Kumaras, who were masters of devotional service, became very pleased. Indeed, they appeared in the sky and praised the character of the king. And everyone observed them. Purport. It is said that the demigods never touch the surface of the earth. They walk and travel in space only. Like the great sage Narada, the Kumaras do not require any machine to travel in space. They're also residents of Siddhaloka who can travel in space without machines. Since they can go from one planet to another, they are called Siddhas. That is, they have acquired all mystic and yogic powers. Such great saintly persons who have attained complete perfection in mystic yoga are not visible in this age on earth because humanity is not worthy of their presence. The Kumaras, however, praise the characteristics of Maharaj Prithu and his great devotional attitude and humility. The Kumaras were greatly satisfied by King Prithu's method of worship. It was by the grace of Maharaj Prithu that the common citizens in his domain could see the Kumaras flying in outer space. Maitreya Uvacha Tat Atma Yogapattaya Adi Rajena Pujitaha Shilam Tadiyam Shamshanta Ke Bhavan Mishatam Rinam. The great sage Maitreya continued, being thus worshipped by Maharaj Prithu, the four Kumaras who were masters of devotional service became very pleased. Indeed, they appeared in the sky and praised the character of the king, and everyone observed them. Om Agyanate Mirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Umnitam Gena Taishmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So this has got some unique points in the purport about yogics, mystic yogic cities, and flying around in the sky. As well as, I think the most interesting point, I mean, for those of us who haven't had contact with mystic yogis, maybe you'd like to hear me speak about these mystic powers. But I think the most relevant point to each of us is probably this last sentence. It was by the grace of Maharaj Prithu that the common citizens in his domain could see the Kumaras flying in outer space. That sentence brings up the whole discussion of the Vedic process of knowledge acquisition. There are three pramanas. There's more than that, but these are the three main ones that are emphasized in by Śrīla Prabhupāda. The first being pratyaksha pramana. Anybody know what that is? Sense perception. Correct. So, and then Aruman Praman, this is kind of inductive reasoning, you know, theorizing. That's also based upon sense perception. And then there's Shabda Praman, right? This is based upon hearing from higher authority. So which of these three are the most reliable? Anybody? The last one, Shabda Praman. And what's wrong with the first two? There's some inherent fallibility within these first two means of knowledge acquisition. Anybody know? Kidanagari Prabhu.
Our senses aren't perfect.
Yeah. There's more to the infallibility than that. Matter of fact, there's four factors that are considered by philosophers in our line. You got one of them. It goes back to the defects of the conditioned soul. There's four defects. To make mistakes, yeah. An illusion. Anybody know the Sanskrit on those? No? You'll learn that in Ishopanishad. Don't worry. Hang in there. So, yeah. Brahma, the tendency to make mistakes. Right? That's, to err is human. Huh? And then Pramada, that's the tendency to be illusioned, to take something, to accept something which is not the case, right? Like we have a tendency in our conditioned state to accept the body as ourselves. Right? This is pramada. And then vipralipsa is a cheating propensity. Srila Prabhupada says this is the most deep-rooted one. And this is presenting oneself as something greater than oneself. This is how Srila Prabhupada oftentimes explains it. And, you know, the mundane academicians are great at doing something like this. You know, they're always giving post-dated checks. You know, they're always fluffing things up in such a way that people are inclined, you know, they use real big words, you know, intellectual phraseology, and so they get people to buy in to and accept almost as factual their anuman praman, you know, their inductive reasoning. For instance, Darwinian evolution, right? That's a big one, you know, and it's absolutely no proof whatsoever that this goes on, you know, and it's accepted, it's taught, you know, even though it may not be explicitly stated that this is a theory and a theory only, but the way it's presented, there's a strong implication that this is the way it is. And so most people, without much thought, consider it, yeah, this is factual. This is, you know, we came from monkeys. And so it's a very, very absurd theory. What to speak of the Big Bang theory, you know, out of complete disorder comes this order. I remember having discussions when I would distribute books in the airport in America, and someone would you know, bring up evolution or bring up the Big Bang Theory in the course of my selling them a book. And then I would say, I don't know if you're aware of it, but this airport that we're standing in right now, there was no architect. There were no blueprints. It just manifested by chance. And I don't know if you're aware of it, there were huge headlines in the New York Times about this phenomenon. And you believe this, so am I right? You know, I mean, so they kind of see the fallacy, you know, in their reasoning, you know, and they usually would end up buying a book. It was somehow or other with my small brain, you know, Krishna gave me a little intelligence to, and you know, even some really big scientists, they would say, well, you got a point there. So at any rate, there's, you know, in some of Srila Prabhupada's last translations in the 13th chapter of the 10th canto, he makes the point of two basic categories of knowledge acquisition. And Pratyaksha and Anuman would fall into the first one, and that's Arohapanta. Arohapanta. This means, this is the materialist way of acquiring knowledge. And it's kind of by force of one's own intellectual strength based upon sense perception. And even if one recognizes the fallibility of his sense perception, then instruments that are created by human intelligence, but it's all based upon human endeavor, human perceptions, and the intrinsic fallibility that's there based upon the four defects of the conditioned soul. And then there's another process. Prabhupada, first he gets into a discussion of the difference between chincha, which is based upon logic and reason, and achincha, which goes beyond logic and reason. And he quotes Jiva Goswami in his commentary in this section. Jiva Goswami describes, unless we can accept achincha in the Supreme, we can't really accommodate a conception of God. Okay, so there's achincha factor beyond rhyme and reason, beyond human intellect. So the way to acquire this kind of knowledge is avarohapanta. Ava comes, is the same preface, it's in avatar. So this avarohapanta, it's knowledge coming from a superior source, coming down from authority. And so this is the Vedic, the most powerful and reliable source of knowledge acquisition. Okay, so getting, you're probably wondering, what is this devotee talking about? What's that got to do with today's verse and purport? Okay, so hopefully we'll clarify this. The Kumaras were greatly satisfied by King Prithu's method of worship. It was by the grace of Maharaj Prithu that the common citizens in his domain could see the Kumaras flying in outer space. Has anybody ever seen anybody flying in outer space? So, what comes to mind is a famous shloka from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu in this connection. And Prabhupada, actually, this topic is covered earlier on in this chapter, in text 9. There's a whole discussion about being able to see the Kumaras there. And Atashi Krishna Namadi Naba Vedgrayam Indriyai Sevan Mukehi Jivado Swayameva Spiratida. So because Krishna's form, his qualities, his activities are all on the absolute platform, our indriyai, our blunt material senses, cannot appreciate them. Right? But then sevan mukhe, when one engages in the Krishna in Krishna's service, beginning with the tongue, jiva do, by chanting Hare Krishna and tasting Krishna prasadam, then the senses are gradually purified. So sevan mukhe, Prabhupada, in a word for word in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, this appears in the 17th chapter of Madhya Leela, he gives a long definition that when someone serves Krishna, then Krishna, through his internal energy, Hare, reveals to the jiva his form, his qualities, and his pastimes, which normally wouldn't be perceivable. Same thing with the Vaishnava. Prabhupada in text 9, he cites the example of how when Sanatana Goswami went to meet with Chaitanya, was that in Varanasi? I think it was in Varanasi. Chaitanya sent Chandrasekhar Acharya out to invite the Vaishnava that was standing in the door in. But Chandrasekhar Acharya, he saw a Muslim mendicant. He didn't see a Vaishnava. You know, so, and we know that we can look at our own lives as, you know, as we came to the point of taking up Krishna consciousness, we can see that we also may not have really understood the stature of, let's say, Srila Prabhupada. I remember when I got my first book 4 years before I joined, and I was just flabbergasted with the philosophy. It just like was mind-blowing. I felt, of course, I was part of the hippie subculture, so to be intoxicated was a normal way of life. But I had never experienced intoxication induced by reading a book. So it was a very unique experience for me. I mean, it was amazing. The best high I'd ever had. But what was, and actually, you know, I had many questions, and particularly was, I couldn't really, the philosophy really clicked in, you know, it really made sense to me, but I couldn't relate to, you know, this pastime of, who was it, the deity that bore witness, what's his name? Sakshi Gopal. You know, there's a deity? I mean, here I am, I'm born in a Christian country, you know, and never really was a Christian, never bought into the whole thing. But still in awe, you know, a deity, and a deity that walks half the way across India to bear witness, pretty unusual. And I had questions, everything else really clicked, but I couldn't relate to that. But I was living in the middle of nowhere, and I had no devotee association, but so I didn't really read the book again. I had these questions that lingered in my mind up to the time when I actually joined the movement. But I would, from time to time, I would pick up this King of Knowledge, this little book, and I would look with great fascination at the photograph of Srila Prabhupada in the back of the cover. And I just said, wow, what an amazing looking personality. I couldn't really, I was respectful, but very inquisitive. You know, I couldn't really figure out what it was all about. And so it's also true, Prabhupada makes this point in the ninth text, purport, that just as our material senses can't perceive the qualities and pastimes of the Supreme Lord, we also can't really understand the Vaishnava, the stature of a Vaishnava. So this Avaroha Panta, You know, and it's an interesting process. It's very mystical. It's not because we're dealing with, you know, what we would, you know, what empiricists would describe as extrasensory perception, because it goes beyond the material senses. So it's like a, it's a whole mystical process how it works. And after Krishna describes to Arjuna in the fourth chapter all these different sacrifices that lead to knowledge, okay, then the you know, the grand finale of this discussion is, well, how do you get this knowledge? How is it actually, what's the best way to get this? And then the famous Tadviri Panipate Na verse, Priya Prashnina Sevaya, Upadekshanti Te Ganam Ganinas Tattva Darshanam. So just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, Panipatena. And so then there's a real combination, you know, and what's really interesting is that there's a whole demonstration of how this takes place that Prithu Maharaj has given to his citizens. You know, first of all, he's instructing in the previous chapter, he instructs his citizens, gives shiksha to them. Functions basically as their spiritual master. And then the Adi Guru of the Sampradaya, the four Kumaras, appear on the scene. And, you know, actually in the 17th chapter of this canto, Prabhupada in a purport describes how Prithu Maharaj has accepted Sanat Kumar as his guru. I think there was some confusion about that yesterday, but it was actual in black and white stated that that was the case. So, to the Adi Guru of the Sampradaya, like for instance to the Prabhupada, you know, I mean, ISKCON is kind of like it's almost a Sampradaya in itself because it's so unique. No time in the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism is such a phenomenon developed. Look around, look at all the different cultures that it represented. Is mind-blowing, you know, how this has taken place. And each devotee has got his own trajectory of how, you know, he acquired bhakti-mukhi sukriti, acquired the qualification to begin the practice of uttama bhakti. Whether we're actually doing uttama bhakti or not, that's another discussion. But at least, you know, we're on the panchanga bhakti express elevator. So the Adi Guru has a special position. Like, you know, in 1992, the GPC passed a resolution, you know, establishing Srila Prabhupada's preeminent position as the founder Acharya and the foundational Shiksha Guru for all of ISKCON. And Harinam Chintami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, makes the point that the Adi Guru, Sanat Kumar, the Kumaras, are the Adi Gurus of the Kumar Sampradaya, or the Nimbarka Sampradaya. And so they have a special position. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes that one cannot become a Shiksha Guru unless he's fully, unless he's a saintly person and fully understood the teachings of the Adi Guru. So that's, you know, we can through manina, we can understand manina, we can understand that that's the qualification for a Diksha Guru within ISKCON. He's fully understood the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, and therefore he's qualified to give instruction. So this is the case with Prithu Maharaj. He's given instruction. Now the Adi Guru comes and he's given instructions. So how is it that the common citizens could see the four Kumaras, who generally speaking can't even be seen in this age, because, you know, Prabhupada in the purport makes the point that in this age, you know, the siddhas, they don't even come to this planet because it's so sinful. People can't see them. They don't have the qualification to see them. So how is it that the common citizens could see? So Prabhupada in the last purport, he says, by the grace of Maharaj Prithu. So this brings up this whole discussion of how Avaroha Panta works. It's all based upon the guru-disciple relationship, where it comes from. And that's Krishna's point of view. You know, Tadvidi Panipatena, Paripashnena Sevaya. So there's a two-pronged approach that the disciple must have. Paripashnena, so there's submissive inquiry, and then that's coupled with Paripashnena Sevaya, with service. The two must go together. If it's not there, if the service is not there, if there's just inquiries, they're not considered to be serious, because it's actually by the blessing of Guru that the knowledge is revealed. This, so to see, you know, like Prabhupada in text 9 in this chapter describes, you know, the internal energy, Hare, reveals Krishna's, this knowledge, this transcendental knowledge. So Rupa Goswami describes it as the chit shakti. This chit, like for instance, when one achieves the platform of bhava bhakti, Ludini shakti and the chit shakti descend in a major dose into the heart of the devotee. And so that chit shakti is a high dosage of sensual purification. The spiritual senses can then begin to directly perceive Krishna, right, on the platform of bhava, enabling one to actually enter the pastimes of the Lord. So, you know, on any level, this realization, this understanding of vigyan, understanding Krishna, our relationship with Krishna, this comes about through mercy, through blessings. Prabhupada, in the purport to text 434, he describes that when the disciple passes the test of the guru, he blesses him with understanding. This, now, this is how it works. We have to please the guru to satisfy him. So, you know, Prabhupada in this purport says that the disciple accepts the spiritual master in full surrender. So there was a discussion at the end of yesterday's class about that full surrender. It's not that it's done blindly, so that, but it is full surrender. And Prabhupada, through his own example, and also Maharaj Prithu through his example, shows how that's done. And Prabhupada, you know, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he made it clear to everybody in the Gaudiya Math that he wanted Lord Chaitanya's mission spread to the English-speaking world. Every single Gaudiya Math member knew that this was what Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur wanted. And who did it? That's full surrender. Srila Prabhupada, Vyavyasi Atmika Buddhi, he made it one with his heart. You know, it was complete focus, complete surrender, complete faith that by doing this, everything would be accomplished. Full pleasure to Guru, full pleasure to Krishna, and the empowerment to carry out the mission. It was full surrender to the instruction. Now, it may be, like for instance, on Srila Prabhupada's first meeting with Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he went with his friend, what was his friend's name? Was that Tarun Ghosh? Narendranath Ghosh. Mulek, okay. Said, Prabhupada didn't really want to go. to visit this sadhu because he had such a bad impression from all the sadhus that his father would bring for lunch, and he could see that most of them were bogus. So he had he was hesitant, but Narendra Malik, coaxed him. So when they went into the room, and they offered dandavats before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and while they were still on the floor, they hadn't even gotten up yet, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, "You're educated young men. You should dedicate your life to preaching Lord Chaitanya's message to the English-speaking world." My God, first words out of his guru's mouth. So, it wasn't, Prabhupada, in the true spirit of a genuine disciple, he wanted to clarify this because he was wearing the kadi of a follower of Gandhi, and he bought in to some extent, that unless India had achieved Swaraj, no one would take Lord Chaitanya's message seriously. Right? So he went back and forth. But at every doubt that he had, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was able to very, very adequately defeat. And so Prabhupada was completely satisfied. There was no... He didn't blindly follow, but he was convinced on the basis of superior argument coming in disciplic succession. So he surrendered. But on the spot, he accepted in his heart Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur as his guru, and that was it. And he just maintained that through the rest of his life, and that instruction came to him in different forms over the next seven times. I think he had Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's vapu seven times after that. That was it. But that same instruction came in one form or another. And then, 2 weeks before Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur left his manifest Leela, Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada had written a letter to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and said, "I'm a grahastha, what can I do for your mission?" And again, he said, "You'll do well if you preach to the English-speaking world." So it went deep in his heart. He read, "This is the same instruction. This is my life." And he made it his life. There's this one, it's just a complete focus. I'm trying to think of the name of this Mataji that wrote this book. Shreshwar will know. Ula Prakriti. Prabhupada, a friend to all. And this, she interviewed all of these personalities that knew Srila Prabhupada prior to his starting ISKCON, after he started ISKCON. But what I found to be most interesting were those that met Prabhupada prior to his starting ISKCON. And there was one Babaji that was born in Radhakund and had been a pujari for 87 years, and he was doing service in a temple right next to the Radhadamodar temple. And on several occasions, he was awoken in the middle of the night, and he heard this unusual crying. And he couldn't figure out what it was, and he just kind of rolled over and went back to sleep. So one night, he went up on the roof of his building. It just kind of caught him. There was this intense crying. And so he went on the roof of his building and looked down in the courtyard of Rupa Goswami's Samadhi and Bhajan Kutir. And he saw B.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami on his hands and knees cleaning the ground in front of Rupa Goswami's samadhi. And this intense cry, "Oh Rupa, please empower me. Please give me your mercy." And this Baba was so impressed. The next day he went down and he wanted to be his servant. So he became kind of Srila Prabhupada's secretary. He would, you know, many people would come to visit him and he would filter them out and say, no, Swamiji's busy writing now. He can't be disturbed. You know, he would do his laundry, he would cook for him, different things. But he could understand, you know, why Srila Prabhupada was so successful. Because, you know, his bhajan was so deep, his focus was so deep, but it was all based upon this intrinsic principle, this relationship between guru and disciple. He had fully surrendered to this instruction. He had complete faith that by doing this he would achieve perfection in his service to Krishna. And so he did. And he had complete, talk about complete faith. My God, you know. He went to America, 40 rupees in his pocket, which was the equivalent in those days of what? Maybe
$5.
Okay. And then he started book distribution. He sold a set of his Bhagavatams to Captain Pandya and his wife. And he increased his assets by 5 times. He brought it up to $25. He got a $20 donation for the Bhagavatam set. Had 2 heart attacks, didn't really know anybody, didn't have institutional support. Just went out into the wild blue yonder to start ISKCON. But what he had the holy name, he had the order of his guru, and everything that he needed to know was provided. You know, he tapped into the supra mundane intelligence. You know, Krishna guided every step of the way. So that's essentially, you know, because of the attitude that's described in the previous chapters. The attitude that the citizens had towards Pitu Maharaj and their acceptance of him as their authority as a Vaishnava. You know, so he functioned both as a Kshatriya and as a Brahmin in that relationship, which a Vaishnava can do. You know, he can wear many hats. But on the basis of that relationship and their mentality and their service to him, you know, their capacity to see the Kumaras was awoken. Okay. So I'll stop here. Let me just read the translation. Maybe there's some questions or comments. The great sage Maitreya continued, "Being thus worshipped by Maharaj Prithu, the 4 Kumaras who were masters of devotional service became very pleased. Indeed, they appeared in the sky and praised the character of the king, and everyone observed them." Itai Priya Prabhu?
In the beginning of your class, you made mention of there are 3 ways of acquiring knowledge. That the first 2, they're not very good. So like an interesting story comes to mind regarding the first one, how we shouldn't rely entirely on our senses for actual knowledge. So there was an Englishman who came to India to come and explore. And he came to a riverbank and he saw a mind-blowing scene. He saw the local women, they would dip the cloth into the water and beat it against the rocks to wash. So when he saw this, he came to a conclusion and he wrote this to his friends in his country. These are the exact words he wrote. Indians are so stupid. They are trying to break a rock with a wet cloth. So this shows how we can't rely entirely on our senses.
We could also see a lot of stupidity in some of the theories that the scientists have. That they're thinking that your body and your brain, the whole nervous system, your blood vessels, took place by chance. Come on, that's just, it's asinine, complete insanity to think that something like so highly complex could take place by chance. Get an aggregable?
I was going to ask that in this purport, Prabhupada says that the people of Kali Yuga, we can't see the siddhas from the siddha loka because we're just too low class, too fallen. So when I hear that, I wonder, well, if we're so fallen, so low that we're not worthy enough, I think he uses the word worthy enough, to see the siddhas, I couldn't help but thinking, are we just totally in illusion, or totally to even think that we're going to go back to Godhead? So we can't even see the siddhas, and the siddhas are just material yogis on...
Well, these siddhas aren't material yogis.
Well...
They're adigurus, you know, the Kumara Sampradaya. But, no, just as Srila Prabhupada had complete faith in Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's order, if we have complete faith in our Adiguru's order, and I think that we can isolate the core instructions that Srila Prabhupada has given, you know, to everyone within ISKCON. And you can look at text 10.2.30, and I'll just paraphrase the translation. I haven't memorized. It's not a famous verse, although it should be in my mind. That the acharyas surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord, and therefore they discover the means to cross the ocean of material nations. And they leave this means behind for other devotees to cross. And Krishna accepts those means. Okay, so then there's a discussion in the purport. This is very powerful, of how, according to time, place, circumstances, and the candidates, the acharya develops the means for his disciples to go back to Godhead. Okay, and Prabhupada makes it quite clear that his core instructions are that you chant 16 rounds, you follow the regulative principles, you attend the morning program, you study his books, and you dedicate your life to pushing his mission out. Okay, so now here's I've got real evidence of the efficacy of this procedure, and I'm going to present that now. Now, in the early days of the Juhu project, it was a very, very challenging project. And Srila Prabhupada's right-hand man in developing this project was Tamal Krishna Goswami. And at one point, it was very challenging on all levels. you know, the whole Mr. Nair episode, and you know, one thing after another. So one time, Tamal Krishnamurti said to Srila Prabhupada, "Srila Prabhupada, how can I think of Krishna? My mind is just filled with temple finances." And Prabhupada's response was, "So many lifetimes we have wasted on ourselves. If just in this one lifetime we dedicate heart and soul to pushing on Lord Chaitanya's movement, then at the end, even if we're not perfect, Lord Chaitanya will come and he'll cover what we lack, and he'll personally take us back to Godhead." Okay, so I personally witnessed this taking place with my Sankirtan partner for 18 years, Nirguna Prabhu. He wasn't practicing Raga Nuga Bhakti, but I, you know, over the 18 years that we had each other's Sangha, I observed that he was an extremely dedicated person to pushing the movement on. Just to give you an example, we did, you know, we'd go, like, say, to the Atlanta airport, and we'd come back after a hard day of distributing books, you know, to the businessmen of America. And, you know, we'd stop to fill up the gas tank. As they say in India, we stop to get petrol. And everyone else would be just kind of like, you know, just recovering from, you know, having businessmen swing briefcases at them and, you know, just getting traumatized, you know, by the heavy American modes. But Nirguna, as soon as the van would stop, he'd jump out and he'd start selling books to people waiting in line to get their gas filled up. He'd start selling books to the gas station attendants, and just completely on fire. And it was not an irregular event. It was a continuous flow of that type of enthusiasm and determination. No matter what happened, you know, his wife of 20 years just walked out on him. What did he do? He went on a Polish tour and just became absorbed in preaching. So, you know, and this is something that Hari Sari chronicled. You know, I saw the last 5 weeks, very, very challenging circumstances. You know, his he had a huge tumor in his chest, and, you know, his the tumor ate into his spinal cord, and he became paralyzed from the waist down. And with the paralysis came excruciating pain. And we discovered through trial and error that that pain would be relieved by vigorous, and I mean vigorous, massage of his feet and legs. So we organized a team to do 24/7 massage. We had 34 devotees doing that. And it was around the clock. And even in his sleep, if he didn't get this vigorous massage, he would wake up in this excruciating pain that would take hours to, you know, subdue through vigorous massage. So it was a great way for him to connect with the devotee. You know, my wife and I were the only ones that really knew him in all of Mayapur, but became very, very close with so many devotees, you know, in the 4 months that he was here. And then, you know, right at the end, you know, he chanted his 60 rounds every single day up to last day, even though, you know, he could barely talk. One would have to put their ear right on his mouth, like an inch away, in order to hear his faint whisper. He only weighed, I think at the end it was 35 kgs. His thigh was the size of my wrist at the end. He was so weak. And then I very, very vividly remember this. And Radhakund's appearance day, I got Jayapataka Swami on the phone. He was in Los Angeles. I did this, you know, Nirguna had served as a temple president of the Murari Sevak Farm under Jayapataka Swami. He also did a Sankirtan leader in Atlanta. You know, this Jayapataka Swami is GBC zone at the time. So I had Jayapataka Swami and I was going to connect him. I put, you know, headphones, my ears, headset, you know, from my mobile phone in Nuguna's ears, and then he would talk. He had a relationship with Nuguna Swami, Radha Swami. So this is 9:15 p.m. on the appearance day of Radha Kund, and I went to Nirguna. Most of the devotees had left for the evening. Just a handful were there still doing some kirtan. Grahilda Prabhu was massaging Nirguna's feet at the time. And I went to Nirguna and said, "Nirguna, Jayapataka Swami will speak with you in 5 minutes." And Nirguna pushed me away. Like I was bugging. What's going on? They were very close. They were very close with each other. So I went to Grahilda and I whispered to him, "What's going on with Nirguna?" And he said, "I don't know, Jamasini, but I think he's about ready to leave his body." So we had a doctor, Dr. Avni. She was being trained in palliative care in the Bhaktivedanta Hospital. And he was there for the last month of Nirguna's life. In the Bhaktivedanta Hospital, arranged this through Radha Swami's mercy. So I woke him up and said, you know, I told him what Grahilda said, and he checked the vital signs of Nirguna. He said, "Yeah. You know, he's got a few hours left." So then I called everybody back, and we began an all-night kirtan. You know, Hari Sari, he just had fallen asleep. Janani Vas Pankajangri, Pavan Lochan, Bhakti Vishwambar Madhava Swami, they all came back, and we had about 20 devotees. We were going all night long. Kurma the cook was also there. And he did a 7-hour kirtan all through the night. And then after Mangal Arti, I announced that the situation, Nirguna had lost consciousness and that he wouldn't regain consciousness. That was Avnish's opinion. And that devotee should come, you know, and participate in the kirtan. I quoted Radha Swami in saying, and it's really important, even if they're not conscious at the time of departure, after hearing the holy name, it is extremely auspicious, the soul that will perceive that. I'm going to backtrack a little bit on this story. I'm looking at the clock, so I'm conscious that there's a Bhakti Shastri course and everyone's in their stomach is going to speak, you know, that why did this guy shut up? but going back, you know, maybe 10 days, Nirguna revealed to one of the caretakers that he wasn't sure, but he had some indication that he was a Manjari in Krishna's past, in Krishna Lila. That was his sarup. You know, it was like a kind of like a really powerful, like kind of prompting that came from within. And so this became a subject matter for discussion between Hari Sari and himself. They would regularly talk about this. Hari Sari would come every day and read for an hour to an hour and a half from unpublished sections of his biography. And so, you know, from time to time, Hari Sari would ask him, so Nirguna, and what came out of the discussion? And Nirguna was waiting for an invitation. Right? So then Hari Sari would ask Nirguna, "Have you gotten your invitation yet?" And Nirguna would kind of in a dejected way would hang his head and say. So then, at 7:22 in the morning, you know, I'd made the announcement, there was over 75 devotees. Now the ladies have their Bhakti Shastri class in this 16-by-20-foot classroom. So on the other side of the building, also on the ground floor, this is the first Mayapur Institute classroom, Nirguna was situated, and there were 75 devotees, and there was this incredibly intense kirtan going on. But Dan Mohan Prabhu was actually leading the kirtan. He was a mainstay in the Harinam Sankirtan department. And so he was leading this beautiful kirtan. And Nirguna was laying right, was facing Dewey's. His head was pointed right towards the corner. Bhakti Vishwambar Madhava Swami was right here. I was here. Hari Sari was there. Janani Vas Pankajangi Prabhu Lochan. And all of a sudden, Bhakti Vishwambha Madhava Swami, in his ever youthful four kumara like way, grabbed my leg and said, Jatmastami, scared the daylights out of me. Look, Nirguna, his tongue is moving. He's chanting. And I looked, and sure enough, his tongue was moving, and then it became much more pronounced. He was clearly singing along with the kirtan, and all of a sudden he opens his eyes, and he lifts his arms up, and he has this incredibly blissful look on his face, and he's chanting along with the kirtan, you know, like nothing has going on with his body at all. It completely blew Dr. Avnish's mind, because it completely defied anything that he could understand about the dying process. It was impossible that he'd come back to consciousness. What to speak of having the strength to lift his arms up, because he couldn't even lift a finger. He was so weak, he hadn't eaten in over 5 weeks. He'd just been taking liquid nourishment. So then in this tumultuous kirtan that was going on, and mind you, up to this point, you know, for the last, like, maybe 10 days, in order to even hear anything Nirguna would say, you'd have to put your ear right over his mouth. So then, in the midst of this tumultuous kirtan, Harisari heard Nirguna say in a loud voice, "Get your peace and go. Get your peace and go." And it completely bewildered Harisari. What is he talking about? So his initial thought was, "Get your peace of mind and go." He was thinking something like that. And then he said to Nirguna, "Did someone say something to you, Nirguna?" And Nirguna said, "Yes." And I left out an important element of the whole story. The first BBT plate that Nirguna saw of Krishna was of Giriraj lifting Govardhan. Okay, so he had a very special place in his heart for Giriraj. And one of the caretakers early on in his care put her Giriraj Govardhan Shila right next to Nirguna's bed. And then, you know, as the dying process accelerated, Harisari, you know, the devotees put Giriraj right on Nirguna's chest, so these big bright eyes were looking at Nirguna all the time. And then there was another Govardhan Shila that Harisari put in Nirguna's hand, you know, in the last few hours. So anyway, so then Harisari asked, "Well, Nirguna, did someone say something to you?" And Nirguna replied, "Yes." And then Harisari said, "Who?" "Giriraj." Okay, so then Harisari said, "Okay, so what did Giriraj mean by get your peace and go? What did he mean by peace?" And then Nirguna said, "Giriraj." "Oh." Harisari said, "Okay, so Giriraj told you to take him and go?" And he said, "Yes." And he just like beamed radiantly. And then Harisari said to him, "Nirguna Prabhu, did you get your invitation?" And then in such a deeply, transcendentally satisfied way, he said, "Yes." So, you know, the understanding that Harisari got from that exchange was that he did get his invitation to re-enter the pastimes of the Lord as a Manjari. And so he realized his sarup, which is the qualification for entering Bhava Bhakti. That's a symptom of Bhava Bhakti. And so he achieved a very, very high level of consciousness. And the room, you know, we know there's some Ratiya Bas. Ratiya Bas is described in the Nectar of Devotion as a shadow attachment. If we're in the Asanga of someone who's on the Bhava platform, we experienced some of that ecstasy, some of that bhav. So the room was just unbelievably surcharged with ecstasy. I'd never experienced anything like it. It was just mind-blowing. So, you know, I won't go through the rest of the story, you know, and then they're going to left at 1:22. You know, he spent an hour and a half on the phone with Radhanath Swami and then lost consciousness again. But, you know, no one that was present had any question in their mind that Nirguna went back to the spiritual world. Now, I was asked last year, you know, just prior to Janmashtami, by Giriraj Swami, to speak about Nirguna's departure at the opening of the Bhaktivedanta Hospice. And, you know, what I cited was this conversation that took place between Srila Prabhupada and Tamal Krishnamaraj. And it wasn't the only time that Prabhupada said this. It was like his promise to ISKCON devotees, that if you dedicate your life to pushing in this movement, following the core instructions, at the end, Lord Chaitanya will personally come and take you back to Godhead. And I cited the Nirguna's going back to Godhead is proof, you know, kind of evidence that, you know, a fulfillment of this promise. So then the next morning, Giriraj Swami gave Bhagavatam class, and he gave it on, this is prayers to the demigods, you know, because it's just before Janmashtami on 10:230. And this is the verse I was describing, you know, that the Acharya leaves the means for crossing the ocean of material nations for other devotees, and Krishna accepts this. So, then Giriraj Swami made the point that it's not just Nirguna, but there are many devotees in similar situations that dedicated their lives to pushing Prabhupada's mission, and at the end, in the Sangha of very senior Vaishnavas, they saw the symptoms of very advanced levels of Krishna consciousness, and they similarly went back to Godhead. So, now, up until this point, you know, my understanding, philosophically, you know, I was a Bhakti Shastri student. I took Nectar Devotion two or three times from Giriraj Swami. And typically speaking, one has to actually practice Raga Milga Bhakti to go to Goloka Vrindavan. You know, this is the understanding that comes if you read Dhanadhara Swami's Waves of Devotion. That's the standard procedure for going back to Godhead. Now, Giriraj Swami, I promise I'll end in 3 minutes, okay? All right? I'm not trying, you know, sorry, I know you're probably teaching today. I lost my train of thought. Let's see. Okay, so Giriraj, in giving this class, told this interesting pastime of Srila Prabhupada, where he gave an analogy of how a businessman will send a representative out in the field to conduct business on behalf of the established business, okay? And so he'll go out, he'll negotiate terms with a potential client, and then he'll come back to the office and present the terms that he's negotiated to the proprietor of the business. Now, the proprietor, he selected him as his representative. He may not like the terms that the representative has negotiated, but he's obliged to accept the terms because he's a representative. There's an obvious analogy being drawn. And so Giriraj was just bewildered. How could the guru, you know, do something that Krishna doesn't like? And he said he couldn't really figure it out, you know. And then years later, it dawned on him, and he gave the example of Krishna wanted Subhadra to marry Arjuna, and Balaram wanted Subhadra to marry Duryodhana. So there's, you know, different perspectives. And so the Acharya, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he introduced Brahmacharya Ashram and Sannyas Ashram to the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, and it wasn't going on after Lord Chaitanya's time. There weren't sannyasis and, you know, Vaishnava sannyasis that wasn't given. Brahmacharis. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he made, you know, adjustments according to time, place, circumstances, and the candidate. Because the candidates in Kali Yuga are so low, fallen, Maybe they need some special dispensation. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada did not emphasize practicing Raganuga Bhakti. On the other hand, you know, if Lobha awakens, certainly one should practice it, but he shouldn't manifest it. This is the instruction Rupa Goswami gives. In other words, you don't make a big show out of it, put neon signs, hey, I'm practicing Raganuga Bhakti, come here. There's greener pasture right here, come with me. You know, but the greenest pasture is right within Srila Prabhupada's ISKCON, in the Shaktivesha avatar, who's gotten the empowerment from Krishna, and his core instructions, if they're followed, will achieve the highest level of Krishna consciousness in this lifetime and go back to Godhead in this lifetime. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur apparently said it takes three lifetimes. One is a Kanishtha, one is a Majjhima, and one is a Uttama Bhagavat to go back to Godhead. Prabhupada has made it really clear, one lifetime, that's what's required. But it requires that type of dedication to pushing a mission out, not laying back and, you know, well, I'm chanting my rounds, Prabhu, you know. But, okay, so, Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.